What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Spike Edney. Now, Spike Edney is a musician who, since the 1960s, has performed with a number of bands, but most notably with Queen in their live concerts. I would say most notably, he appeared on stage with them at the infamous 1985 Live Aid concert that they did. We discuss a lot. We discuss the Live Aid experience. We discuss meeting Freddie Mercury for the first and last time. And we also discuss touring with Queen. And now, without further ado, I will give you Spike Edney. Okay, I'm here with Spike Edney. Spike, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Glad to be here. Sorry, just finishing lunch, but we can fit everything in. It's a busy time.
Yep, absolutely. No, I that's why I appreciate taking the time. I'll be brisk. I'm very excited to speak with you, Spike. I wanted to discuss you, Queen, how you brushed with music history. But before we get into all that, please tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm the guy that plays the keyboards for Queen when they tour, and it's a job I've held since the summer of 1984, which was the year that they toured the Works album. And they'd had two keyboard players before me, originally Morgan Fisher from Mott the Hoople, toured with them in 81, and then Fred Mandel toured with them in 82. And then when they came to tour again in 84, Fred Mandel wasn't available, so they needed a new guy, and here I am. And I guess I didn't cock it up. It's because I'm still around.
Excellent. Nothing wrong with that. I'd love to discuss, if you could recall, the first time that you met Freddie Mercury, and what was your initial impression of him?
Well, the first time I would have met him would have been in Munich on the first day of the rehearsal, which was in a large TV studio. And he was friendly, very polite. He's obviously very shy amongst strangers. So I knew that there would be some getting used to. I'd had the previous day with Roger and John, and there had been some, we'd gone out and had dinner, and I'd sort of got to familiarize myself with them. We got sort of quite friendly. And the whole thing with Fred was that once you've proven that you could be trusted, and also know when to speak up and when not to, you know, it's kind of a social awareness guy, if you like. Then he was fine, and he was very generous towards me. And to be honest, I only knew him pretty much when we were on tour together, and I saw a lot of him. And then occasionally there'd be some social interaction. If he was having a party or something, I'd get invited to that. But then he got taken ill quite quickly. So it was only 84 through 87, I think, that I saw him under normal circumstances, you know, under healthy circumstances.
Certainly. Excellent. So you may have already kind of hinted at it in your last answer there, Spike, but how and when did you actually develop a working relationship with Queen?
Oh, I was sent along to audition. And actually, the story is this. The guy who was Roger Taylor's drum tech, a guy called Chris Taylor, no relation. He had worked with a bunch of musicians in a band who were called Merlin. And Merlin were a touring band in the UK that I became friendly with. I was in another band, a little local band from Gosport in the south of England called Smiling Hard. And we would tour around playing club dates and any gigs. You could actually exist without being famous by just playing the venues that were available. So we became really friendly with them. And Chris Taylor, or Chris Dawes, who was also known, was their lighting director. And so a sort of rapport, touring friendship built up between us and them. And in fact, the guitar player of that band, Jamie Moses, is the guitar player in my band, Spike's All Stars. So a relationship that started in 1972, I think. So many years later, I am in London in between gigs waiting for something to happen. And I'm playing in a bar and just eking a living. And one day in comes Chris Taylor. And he says to me, "Hey, how's it going? Long time no see." And I said, "What are you up to?" And he told me the long list of gigs that he had. He said, "But now I'm working for Queen." "Oh, that's great, you know." And he said, "And they're looking for a keyboard player. Do you want the job?" And I went, "Yeah, of course," because that's what you say in those situations. And he said, "Well, put some stuff down on a cassette." And he said, and I'll come back in a week and I'll pick it up off you. And so I did, and never expecting him to return, but he came back and I gave it. And lo and behold, I got a call saying, "This is somebody at the Queen office. Will you be at this address next Monday?" And I thought, wow, okay. And my expectation was that I would be one of 200 people auditioning, because that's the way things used to be back in those days. You'd turn up and sit there and twiddle your thumbs and wait to be called. So I arrived at their office, which was over in Notting Hill in London, quite imposing Georgian townhouse, I remember. And I went in, and there's a very busy looking place with gold records all over the wall and quite imposing. And I said, "Right, up to the first floor." And I thought, "Oh, that must be where they're seeing everybody. I'll be sat there." And I walk up there and there's nobody there, just an empty office. I thought, "Oh, that's very bizarre." So I sit there. Then the door opens and in comes a man who I later learned to be a man called Jerry Stickles. And anybody who knows anything about Queen will know who he was and what he did. And so he said to me, "Right, have you got a passport?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Are you available for the next 8 months?" And I went, "Well, I was unemployed at the time." I said, "Yeah, under my breath, I'm available for as long as you like."
Yeah.
And he said, "Right, well, on Monday, then I'll get you a ticket and you'll fly out to Munich to start rehearsals." And I said, "Well, this is ridiculous." Well, I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. This is not how this happens. And I said, "Okay, so I'm flying out next Monday. What happens if I get there and they don't like me?" And he said, "Well, on Tuesday, you'll fly back." And so that was that. So I flew out to Munich, had a night on the town with Roger and John. We started the next day. And it's a ridiculous story. And maybe there are other people with a similar way of joining up with one of the world's greatest bands, but I don't know many.
That's fantastic. I love it. I feel the need to ask. If you'd rather not answer, just tell me and I'll move on. But what's a night out with Queen like?
Well, it depends what era you get them.
Fair.
I came along just after, really, they'd had their wild days. And also, when you're rehearsing for a tour, you don't really want to go crazy, because you've got to have your wits about you for the rehearsal. But once you get out on the road and things relax a little bit, I mean, we've had some great nights, but invariably it involves staying up very late and drinking vast amounts of sake or something like that. And then living to tell the tale and hoping to remember all the stories that happened. And, you know, but I'm afraid you'll have to wait for my book for all the stories.
I love it. I think you did a Rolling Stone interview a while back, and I think I read this right. Is it true that you were the one that asked Queen to play Live Aid?
No. Yes and no. Okay. I didn't invite them. What I did was to act on behalf of Bob Geldof, who I knew very well and had worked with in the Boomtown Rats. As he was putting together the lineup for Live Aid, he was trying to get through to as many artists on a personal level rather than going through the regular channels, because as I have found, when you are putting on a charity event and you want people to play for nothing, it tends to happen that the management and the agents don't see a percentage and are therefore not very helpful, because why would they be?
What's in it for them?
Yeah, there's nothing in it for them. So if somebody you know asks you to do something, you're far more likely to consider it and be responsive. So he asked me to gauge them, and which is what I did. We were flying out to start a Far Eastern tour. We were in New Zealand, I believe. And it was a very long flight to New Zealand from England. And we arrived at some ridiculous time. And that night we did go out to dinner. And at the end of the dinner, I said, "Okay, I've got this question from Bob Geldof." And now, obviously, they knew that the Band-Aid single had been number one all over Christmas. And it was a big deal that all these musicians and rock stars got together and selflessly made this record on behalf of the Ethiopian famine relief. And I think they were, well, I know Roger mentioned the fact that he would like to have been asked to be involved in that. He would have certainly taken part in that record. And the feeling was kind of throughout all of them that they were supportive of the cause. So I said, well, Geldof said to me, I'm planning a live show that's going to involve all these millions of artists in both London. And originally he said Shea Stadium in New York. And he said, it's going to be live and broadcast live around the world. And it's going to be one band will play a song in London, then another band will play in New York. And then that was the fullest. And I said, you haven't got a hope in hell of making that work. It just won't happen, you know. And so he said, oh, yes, it will. I've got Harvey Goldsmith, a big London agent, to help me. And so anyway, I did ask on his behalf, and I laid it out to them. I said, he's got this stupid idea of doing this show, and he wants to know, are you up for being involved in it? And it was John Deacon who said, well, why doesn't he ask us himself? And I said, he will do, but only if he knows you're going to say yes. So they all looked at each other, and they all shrugged their shoulders, which I've learned to mean that it's a unanimous decision. If you get a shrug, that's about as positive an answer you're going to get. And so there we are. I phoned up Geldof that night from Australia, from New Zealand, and I said, well, they seem to think that they're up for this. And then he called the manager the next day, and the whole thing started. So,
little did you know, right?
Yeah, I did. Well, I didn't believe for one second it would happen. I thought it was just way too grand a plan.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it did, obviously.
Excellent. I'd love to talk a little bit about the artistic decision to do a 20-minute set as a medley, particularly, in my opinion, starting with Bohemian Rhapsody, you know, infamously long song, quite daring. Can you tell me a little bit about what informed that decision?
Well, two things. They were quite well-versed in medleys. If you look back at any live performance of theirs in the 70s, they would often medley songs together, verse and a chorus, and move on. So it was nothing new. Also, Bohemian Rhapsody, I think, was only ever played up until the guitar solo in those early days, because obviously there was four of them on stage and they would chop it up. I think it was a medley where they went to another completely different song in the middle section where the opera would happen normally. They just played another song and then they would finish that song and come back with the fast bit of bow rap and finish it off. So there was no... It was almost a no-brainer, really, that they, in 20 minutes, they would choose to do a bunch of stuff and get through it quite quickly. And there was no magic formula to it. We actually said, what are the biggest hits, or what are the hits that are going to resonate with the crowd? And with the exception of Hammer to Fall, which had been a big hit, it was their most recent hit, I think. Everything else was a big classic. Oh, no, Radio Gaga had been recent as well. But we knew that was a crowd-pleaser, and, of course, seeing that crowd do the clap was a fantastic thing. So it was a workmanlike thing, and I was there with a stopwatch, you know, and it was my job to time everything and then figure out the transitions from one to the next and how much we're going to do. But like I say, they were well versed in that, so it wasn't arduous or mentally challenging, really. The only difficult one was to decide which songs were going to be left out, you know, because there were so many they could have done. So,
hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Yeah. Excellent. It's so funny, you know, the intro to this podcast, one of the questions is, you know, what was it like seeing Queen at Live Aid? So for the last few months, I've been floundering away trying to find someone who saw Live Aid. And here I have the extraordinary opportunity to talk to someone that was on stage with them during Live Aid. So it'll be a cliche question, Spike, I'm sure, but interesting nonetheless. When you were on stage with Queen at Live Aid, did you have any sense of the historic nature of the performance?
No, but what I did have a sense of was that, what time did we get on stage? Was it something like 7 o'clock in the evening?
Yeah.
And I had been there as an audience member up until that point. I had my backstage pass or whatever, but didn't want to get in anybody's way. So I watched the show from various points around the arena to see what the stadium, just to see what it sounded like and to gauge things. And I have to say that it was a sunny day, and it was had the air of a bit of a picnic for most of it, and because there was a lot of sort of gentle meandering going on with, at the piano with various artists and various songs. And then some people made the mistake of trying to play their new single, which, of course, most people, it was a lead balloon reaction to that kind of thing. Nobody had really grabbed the audience, with the exception of, I think, Dire Straits was on, and it started to pick up in its vibe. But I hate to use the word soporific, but it was a lazy afternoon feeling. And we hit the stage and kicked off, and the atmosphere changed instantly into a gig, a proper gig. And I think you'll hear Geldof has been quoted as saying he was in the middle of an interview, and he all of a sudden his ears pricked up, and he jumped up to see what was going on and said that it had completely flipped from that lazy afternoon picnic into a gig.
That's awesome. You may have already answered it, Spike, but let me go ahead and ask it. Talk to me a little bit about the energy inside Wembley at the time while you're on stage. Can you recall what you were feeling?
It was very exciting because once we played Radio Gaga with the hand clap, I think Gaga was the second tune. Mm-hmm. And if I was nervous, I wasn't too nervous because I kind of, had faith that we would go over okay because we were match fit and had been touring and knew that what the audience response would be to certain pieces of music. And of course, starting off with Bo Rap, that got everybody's attention and they all went crazy. But then going into Gaga, my only concern was that I have to control the synthesizer part and that goes all the way through it. And I have to play that. And I was just concerned that nothing went wrong with that because earlier in the tour, I'd had some issues with the keyboard and it had it'd been a problem. And my hand slipped on one of the controls and created chaos. It was all stupidity and an operator error. It wasn't the keyboard itself. It was my my handling of it that was wrong. But that had been quite a while before, and I'd got my routine down and learned what to do and what not to do in order to keep it in pristine readiness. And so when we got to the Gaga and I pressed the key that starts off that introduction, my heart was in my mouth, to tell you the truth, because if it hadn't worked, then I just don't know. That the alternative keep me awake at night. Anyway, it worked perfectly, and they all clapped and joined in, and then I thought, okay, we're good to get that kind of reaction on the second song. I knew that we had We Will Rock You and We Are the Champions to come, so it was a done deal. Fish in a barrel after that.
I love it. I'm curious if any differences stand out for you between the actual event, Live Aid, and how it's depicted in Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, completely different. Not necessarily the actual playing in front of the audience. That's pretty good. Just the circumstances and the atmosphere and the band interaction. I think in the movie, it's portrayed as being a reunion comeback gig or something. Of course, it was nothing of the sort. We were match fit. We'd been touring for months. So yeah, it was just a day. It was an unusual day, but it was just a day at the office. You go on stage, you play the songs. Yeah, I mean, we just done something very similar with the Queen's Jubilee on Saturday. Yeah, almost an identical situation. You go on stage, you play for 10 minutes, and you come off. And if you've prepared properly, and if your crew have created the right environment, which they did, I mean, those things can be a nightmare, technically, for a band's crew to get you stage ready to play for 20 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever. So without their dedication and know-how, then, of course, it doesn't happen. So any nerves that come along, actually, we weren't nervous going on. And I had my own personal nerves about not messing up the equipment. but like I say, by the time we got to the end of Gaga, I knew we were gold.
Awesome. Awesome. So I'm curious, so post-performance, you know, after Live Aid, can you recall what the rest of the evening was like for you and Queen after the performance? You get off stage, and what was the rest of that day like for you?
Well, obviously, we hung around. We had another track to play. I had to do Is This World We Created towards the end, just before the big finale of Do They Know It's Christmas? And then there was that sort of like feeling of, A, of relief, B, disbelief that it's actually all gone off with only one or two hiccups, and the fact, and of course it was still going on in America, Philadelphia, but we were all quite exhausted. It was a long day. You had been there because of the traffic. You had to get there early and hang around all day. You do your thing and then you hang around more, and it's tiring hanging around. You lose all your energy. So there was a gathering in a club somewhere in the West End, and as we got there, it was very surreal to see. We have an artist called Cliff Richard. Do you know who Cliff Richard is?
I've heard the name, yeah.
Okay, well, he was the English Elvis. He was our rock and roll hero, whose career spanned from the 50s. Well, he's still going now, through to the present day. But he's a well-known musical figure in the UK. And when we arrived at this club, he was stood at the entrance with a guitar, busking to all the artists that came through, because he hadn't been able to perform at Live Aid. He would have played there, but he had a gig which he couldn't cancel. And so after the gig, he rushed to... We stood there and watched. Here he is, this guy, this household name, playing to us as we're filing in to the club. But after that, I don't really remember much. I'm sure alcohol was involved.
Excellent. So aside from Live Aid, is there a particular performance with Queen that stands out with you for whatever reason?
Yeah. In those early days, the biggest gig I'd ever seen and been at was the first Rock in Rio, which actually happened, I think that was in the January of 85, and Live Aid was in the July. But Rock and Rio back then, I think it was the first time it had happened, so it was the inaugural concert. And all these massive headlining bands and acts turned up to play it. And Queen did the opening night, they did the opening Friday. But then we did the following Friday. Everybody played twice. And so we had a week off in Rio as a holiday between those two shows, and I've never seen such a manically enthusiastic audience. It was terrifying, really. And I don't know, they say it's 500,000 or 750,000. The numbers change depending on who you talk to, but that stuck in my mind as being something really special. I mean, with them, we'd done an arena tour, and I think we played a couple of stadiums in the Far East, but I was only getting used to playing a big stage with a big audience. And I think that one actually made me go, wow, this is now a different level. That's awesome. There's a video of it anyway, live in Brazil. So
excellent.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Excellent. Yes, sir. So when was the last time that you saw Freddie Mercury?
Okay. I saw Freddie Mercury. Okay. I can't be, I'll have to be honest, I can't be accurate about it. I think it was, he died in 1991. Was that November 91?
That sounds right.
I think I saw him probably the year before that in Ibiza. He was staying at Roger Taylor's house on the island of Ibiza. And I sent, dropped a note off saying I was on the island and if he was up for it, you know, coffee, a glass of wine or whatever. And sure enough, he called me, or one of his people called me, I think, and said, Fred wasn't planning on going out much, but I was welcome to go around later that day and say hello and have a glass of wine. And I did, but I have to say he didn't look great. Mm. And I wonder why he had me, let me come round in a way, because maybe he was just bored and he wanted company. I mean, he had people with him, of course, but perhaps he just wanted another face. And anyway, we sat, he had a bottle of wine, we chatted, and I think he had MTV on, and there was music videos showing, and we were discussing the merits of various songs that came up. And it was a surreal 45 minutes of me feeling there's something definitely wrong here, because I hadn't been told anything, but obviously rumors were flying, but nothing had been admitted. And of course, you know, the loyalty code means that we don't talk to the press or speculate about such things. They're private and need to stay that way. So I just went away from there with a personal feeling of dread. And when he eventually passed, you know, I was actually really quite upset. But But inside, I knew that it, something was on its way, yeah, because he didn't look like or seem like the man that I knew.
Yeah. Moving it forward a little bit, Spike, what is the SAS band?
Well, the SAS band came out of a world tour that I did with Brian May when he toured his first album after the sort of the temporary hiatus of Queen being sort of done with after the loss of Fred. So I think he released his album 92, 93, and then it was called Back to the Light. And in that band was Cozy Powell and Neil Murray, who I knew Neil. I didn't know Cozy, but they were had played in Whitesnake. So I'd met Cozy, and they played on the on some of Brian's record. And he had a couple of singers as well. And off we went around the world to quite a lot, actually, sort of establishing Brian's solo career. And then at the end of that tour, in the summer of 94, my hometown, I come from Portsmouth, and part of Portsmouth, next to Portsmouth, a place called Gosport across the water. And they were having a little festival, and the organizer knew, we had a mutual friend, and said, they've got a spare night, would you like to do something? And I said, yeah, I'll do something. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. But fortunately, Cozy and Neil were available. And so then I joked in my guitar playing friend, Jamie Moses from Merlin, that band that I mentioned. And I had a couple of singers, Chris Thompson, who was the singer of Man from Man's Earth Band. He'd been on a few dates with Brian May. And Paul Young, who was a friend of Jamie's. And I think Kiki D, I think, was on that first one. Anyway, Tony Hadley from Spandau Ballet. And all these were people that I'd sort of met via the Queen work that I'd done. And so we just got together and we played a bunch of Queen songs and a bunch of hits, anything that they were associated with. For Cozy and Neil, they were in, Cozy had played in Rainbow with the guitarist, what's his name, Richie Blackmore. And they had a massive hit called Since You've Been Gone. And so, you know, we did that. Chris Thompson sang it. And then we did one or two Queen songs. And just a collection of covers, really, of people that we knew. Anyway, we had so much fun. We said we should do this again. And lo and behold, within about 2 weeks, something else came up. And then something else came up. And then as people went off to go on tour, my initial thought was, oh, well, I should just hang this up. But then I thought, no, well, why bother doing that? If I need another drummer, I'll just get another drummer. You know? And if I need another bass player, I'll just get another bass player. And then I suddenly found that I had three drummers and four bass players and three guitarists that I could call on. Like the start of Mission Impossible, the TV series, the guy just flips through his folder and picks out all the people. And literally, it was like that. And it stayed like that. And so I've built up I think it may be on the website, all the people that have played with the SAS band. And it runs into many thousands by the way.
Spike, I'm curious, do you have a particular moment as a musician that you're especially proud of?
Proud of? Well, it's always good to play iconic gigs like Live Aid and the Queen's Jubilee. I'm quite proud of doing that. I'm sure my mum and dad would have been very pleased to see me playing outside the front of Buckingham Palace, because that doesn't come along every year.
Sure.
So for me, something like that, yeah, I guess. But one of my favourite all-time musical moments is when we were doing, when the SAS band became the house band for Nelson Mandela. And we played his birthday concerts for 3 years. And one of those concerts was in New York at Radio City Music Hall. And we were the house band for all the artists, except for one artist who had his own band, and that was Stevie Wonder.
Hmm.
And when in the day during the sound check, they said, oh, Stevie and his band need to do their thing. Can you leave? And I said, well, I'll leave the stage, but I'm not going anywhere else. So I've got things to do. So we just went and sat in the front row of Radio City Music Hall, me and my band, and watched Stevie Wonder do his sound check. I can say it's without doubt the finest musical experience of my life, I think. It was so wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Did you ever meet Mandela?
Yeah, but in a kind of weird way. One of the shows we did was in South Africa, and it was on a golf course. And I was walking. We were staying in bungalows, and I was walking up towards where the gig was being held. And all of a sudden, I heard this peep, peep. And I look around, and there's this cranky old golf cart coming. And in it is Nelson Mandela's golf cart. and it was moving at about an eighth of a mile an hour. It was so slow. And I had a chat with him as they came alongside and we were walking up. Yeah, they're very surreal. But of course, you know, that's the kind of thing you dream after eating too much cheese, that you, Nelson Mandela was in a golf cart and you had a conversation. Yeah, he was a very nice man.
Extraordinary. Spike Edney, how can people find out about you, sir?
Well, Google me. I think there's only one of me. or sasband.com. There's not too much going on at the moment because obviously I'm out here on tour.
Yeah.
After this is over, or while this is on, I've got to get to the end of the book that I've been threatening for many years. But I have to deliver it at some point this year. So that should be around out next year, I'll think. So there's going to be some. Then I will be all over the place and you won't be able to get away from me, probably.
Excellent. I love it. Spike Edney, thank you so much for taking the time for me. I really appreciate it.
Okay. It was great to talk to you. Good luck.
You too, sir. Take care.
Hey, bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.